This is love,
recovery,
and rock and roll. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Chris.
And this podcast is about our own stories regarding our relationship and recovery from substance abuse.
And with each episode, we'll be sharing our favorite rock songs that relate to the topics that we discuss. That's a little fitting for you and I think, because we met through music.
That's true.
Would you like to expound on that a little, or would you like me to do that?
Why don't you go ahead?
We first met doing a benefit for a Christmas program. It was a rock and roll Christmas, Christmas jam to be exact. Is it okay that we bring that up? Or
sure, why not? I don't think we...
Yeah.
We'd be in trouble.
Sue us? So yeah, she was on keys. I was one of the many singers that they had selected to do a number for the program. And I knew who she was at that point. I was very aware of who she was. She just kind of sort of knew who I was.
I knew that you were the singer that was well prepared and respectful.
Aw.
That's how I remember you.
And we are going to get into some topics throughout the weeks that are going to debate that respectful.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, we've all heard the old adage, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and we thought we would turn this negative phrase around into something positive, love, recovery, and rock and roll. So we should talk about exactly why we decided to do a podcast specifically focused on addiction and recovery, as we aren't professionals when it comes to addiction or helping those.
Well, one of us is kind of a professional. One of us is an addict. The other is a... loved one of an addict, and I think what we'll do is just let the listeners try to figure out throughout the process that it's me.
Okay. You know, and beyond our own relationship and dealing with addiction, we both lost loved ones due to addiction. I've personally lost family and friends due to substance abuse. My aunt was only 13 years old when a drunk driver drove onto the sidewalk and hit and killed her. She was walking home from a church activity and never did make it home. It's been over 15 years since my cousin died because of a drug overdose. His body was discovered just 2 days before Christmas. His funeral was the saddest funeral I'd ever attended. I've watched other friends and family members battle addiction, and some of them aren't with us today. You know, I was apprehensive about doing this podcast because I'm a very private person. I find it difficult to talk about traumatic issues like this. Opening up about these types of things causes me, well, to feel vulnerable and sometimes sad. And it's just not something I prefer to do. One thing, though, is I hope that people don't pity us. We really don't need it. Although our story isn't over, we're doing well. Chris and I discussed the pros and cons about sharing our personal struggles, and we believe that by sharing our story, this will help others in recovery or those who are struggling with addiction.
And I think, back to your vulnerability point, vulnerability, there is a lot of growth in the vulnerability zone, and I know you're not comfortable with it, and I understand that, but there's a lot of room for growth for us in this show, and if we can even help just one person either get out of addiction or perhaps the family member locked in addiction with somebody else with the habits, you know, I think that it's certainly worthwhile and worth giving up some of our anonymity in doing so here.
Definitely.
As we're going to cover many topics over the course of these podcasts, including interventions, detox, rehab, sober communities, triggers and cravings, and many, many more topics.
It's also our plan to share not just only our story, but the stories of others in recovery and those of others that have a friend or a family member or a loved one that has struggled or still struggles with addiction. We're going to start this episode with our story. So here goes. For those of you that are listening to the juicy details and gossip, you'll want to pay attention. Some of you may already be aware about what's been happening in our lives and To our friends that are unaware, well, we apologize for the shock treatment you're about to receive. So, Chris, go ahead. Tell your story.
What story?
Well,
I was born in Salt Lake City back in 19...
Let's not give those details away.
19-something.
Exactly. We don't want to let that go. It could be an answer to a secret question.
And shock treatment. I love it. We got a lot of that in residential. I started, the very first thing I ever did was drink. I had my first drink on Christmas Eve at the age of 15 years old. And had two drinks that evening. And drinking eventually led to using pot. And I'll kind of tie those two together. I think I started drinking heavily at the age of 18, right before I graduated. Well, right before I was supposed to graduate high school, I had a very good friend murdered in downtown Salt Lake. And I was close friends with some other people that loved him, and he had a big family. I was close with them. And we spent that entire week drinking. And I think that was probably my first go-round with being able to bury feelings through drinking. And you just don't see it coming. Without jumping around too much here, I kind of was using pot a lot at the time. I felt I was a big proponent of marijuana until just a little over 3 months ago. It was only a few months after I started drinking, I started smoking pot, and then they both became synonymous. And then I started using pain pills. I experienced some migraine headaches and had a doctor just hand them to me without really even asking. And I started using them, and when the headaches went away, I didn't think to go back to the doctor to try to get some. But then I lost another friend at about the age of 24 who it was suicide. He was in a dark place. I respected his decision, but it was pretty tormenting to me to deal with that, because I was supposed to be his best friend. It's a little hard to swallow sometimes. I had people that I was working with at the time, as well as some of their spouses, handing me pain pills right and left, as well as benzodiazepines. And it got to the point where I really started abusing them daily at that point. I ended up going back to the doctor and was pretty much given the prescription as I saw fit, as I needed to get it. Probably a little too easily, but you know, I'm a big boy, and I took those on my own. But by the time I was 30, I was locked in a pill and alcohol addiction that I abused daily. And of course, it was not all day, every day to start, but you think you have something like that under control, you quickly realize one day you wake up. Even though I lived like that for 15 years, I woke up one day and then I was taking the pills earlier in the day but waiting to drink till later, and finding ways to justify all of these things in my head. Addicts become really good manipulators, and we even manipulate ourselves. And that's when you know you've mastered the art of manipulation, is when you can convince yourself of something that you know is not true, real, or authentic, and yet you convince yourself that it is. So I went on that route for several decades and found myself in a situation with my job to where I wasn't able to get up as easily. Of course, never wanting to blame it on the alcohol and the pills. It was just fact, you know, I was tired and they were overworking me, expecting too much of me, which none of that's true looking back, but it felt that way. And I got put on a performance contract. And when I realized that I still couldn't get up, even though my job was in jeopardy, I turned to methamphetamine and I started snorting it. and it destroyed my sinuses, and it didn't take me long to move to snorting or to smoking it from snorting. And I felt like I had it completely under control, but over the course of about a year, I eventually found myself using it daily. And so I was locked in a cycle of wake up in the morning, get a beer, pop a pill, and smoke meth, and get on my way to work. That's if I went to bed the night before. So the benzodiazepines just were kind of peppered throughout the entire addiction. It wasn't something I ever sought, but when they were offered and prescribed, however, I would take them. I would get them and use them to treat anxiety, through which I've since learned better ways to deal with anxiety. You're going to hear me preach a lot about meditation over the course of these podcasts, and I apologize in advance. I'm a little zealot about it, but I love meditation.
Okay, it's a good thing.
Yeah, there's my one plug for meditation for now. Please stand by. So that all led to my intervention. And at this point, let me just flip it back to Amy and ask, when did you realize that there was something wrong with me?
So I initially was aware of your odd sleeping habits. I knew that you had a propensity to be OCD. Sometimes you would stay up all night cleaning. We were also in the middle of selling your house. We were having a baby. Lots of life changes going on. So I didn't really probe too much, but I was definitely concerned. I know there were some nights that you wouldn't sleep for several nights, and that really, really scared me. I remember talking to my mom and my sister about this, going, gosh, you know, Chris is great. He just cleans all the time. Wow, this is wonderful. But he just sometimes doesn't go to bed. And, you know, that nagging feeling never went away. So over time, I'd find you'd fallen asleep in really weird places. You were once on the stairs, in a very uncomfortable position, in the backyard, on the patio furniture, in the garage. You know, I think you've even fallen asleep on the toilet before several times, and the bathtub too. I know you'd take baths and then you would fall asleep, and then you'd wake up hours later and the water was cold. And, you know, meanwhile, I was pregnant at the time. I was so tired. I would go to bed about 10 at night, and, you know, usually I would wake up about 3 just going, okay, he's not there. I need to go and find him. I know once we were on a trip too, you almost fell asleep at the wheel. I watched your eyes kind of shut. I said, hey, what's going on? You don't look like you're doing well. It was in the middle of the day. I remember we swapped driving, but I was really concerned about you being a safe driver, and I just figured it was all the anxiety about life changes in your job. Also, I found that you kind of had this chronic forgetfulness. You were losing your cell phone and your keys and your wallet. And it wasn't just occasionally. Oh, and your glasses too. I mean, there were those, you know, the four things: cell phone, keys, wallet, and glasses. And it wasn't just like every now and again. Sometimes it was multiple times in a day as time went on. And I thought, okay, you know, he's stressed. So I got you the Tile app, and I thought, okay, this will help you find them. And I got you even a man bag, thinking, okay, if you have a central location, it'll make it easier. But it didn't really seem to help. And I know sometimes it made you emotional when you'd misplace these items. And we were on vacation once, just trying to find the car keys. And, you know, we probably were like an hour and a half late. But I didn't want to probe too much because I felt, you know, lots of life changes. I don't want to nag. But I was worried. You also started to lose weight. You weren't eating very well at all. If you were eating, I'd make you food and you'd maybe take a bite or two and you'd be done with it. I really thought that when you came to me and confessed that you had been smoking, not just smoking meth, by the way, this was cigarette smoking, which is something I don't really prefer in a relationship. I don't like to kiss smokers. And I thought, okay, this is it. This is what he's hiding from me. This is what's stressing him out. We're going to be okay. Well, it was true that you were smoking, and it was true that you were trying to give it up, but that was just like deflection. So There was one night, and it was after our baby was born. It was maybe a couple weeks at the most. And again, I had woken up and you weren't in bed, and I went to find you, and I'm checking all the regular places around the house, and I found you in the family room, and you had this weird kind of pipe thing. And I think I had seen them in like movies and stuff, but I just assumed it was a crack pipe. And I woke you up. You were a little bit hard to wake up. And I was a bit mad. I said, "What's going on?" And you told me it was
for CBD oil.
And I believed it, and I wasn't happy about it because I'm not a pot enthusiast, never have been, never will be. And I was irritated that you were smoking it in the house. I didn't know why you were trying to self-medicate with that. So I started to look through your phone, and I found some vague kind of text exchanges that really showed kind of drug seeking behavior. You were asking for a benzo from somebody. You were contacted by another person who was also somebody that was a dealer and you were exchanging pills with. But it was more on their side saying, "Hey, I've got this." I was able to say, "Hey, what's this all about?" the next day. And you'd said, "Oh, you know that person, they're an addict. They've, you know, been addicted to pills. They always try to reach out and see if they can sell stuff. You know that they're, you know, that way." And I thought, okay, well, all right. So you went and were seeking a benzo from somebody. I don't appreciate that. I encourage you to go to a doctor and actually get a valid prescription if you really wanted to go that route rather than to exchange pills. And I bought into the manipulation, but it never sat right with me. So back in November, your adult daughter and son-in-law, they were over, and your son and his wife were over as well. And you were found in our shed with that same pipe. Well, it was probably not the same pipe because I know you confessed to having oodles of them. I've discovered them around the house. And your son-in-law said, "Hey, guess what? I found Grandpa in the garage with this." And we went, "Whoa, something's not right." Fast forward, we had an intervention, and it was good because you accepted the help. So I want to ask you, how did it make you feel when you went to detox and then to rehab?
Terrified. But before I address that, I just want to go back to the not eating the meals you were preparing. Maybe we need to take a look at your cooking.
Well, I'll admit I'm not the greatest chef. It's not always been in my skill set. I'm getting better, but it's not something that I've ever been great at. And okay. That's okay.
Just a little joke to relieve tension, okay? Yeah, detox was when you threatened to take away the drug of choice, we'll call it DOC moving forward here, of somebody locked in addiction. It's a terrifying thought to think. It's the same thing that drives you while you're in the addiction to only focus. That your only focus is making sure you've got that supply you need to get you through life. And so the fear of detox, once I realized that was an intervention coming in, I started trying to think of every excuse I could come up with before you guys even started firing questions at me.
And you were good at the excuses.
Yeah, well, that's part of the mastering manipulation in addiction. So that was definitely huge. But I was scared, you know. I think I lied my way right up to the point of going to detox and then still continued to lie or not be honest about the extent of my use and how much of everything I had been using.
That is true.
So yes, fear, anxiety, realization came in detox of the extent of my addictions and acceptance of the fact that I needed further treatment. Those were big things that I was able to get in detox once I was actually in detox. But going in was terrifying.
Because I noticed you wanted out, especially like the first day, and I was really worried you were going to leave early, but you stayed.
Yeah, the reason I couldn't get a hold of you that next day And once I realized that you were intentionally not accepting my calls, I left a pretty badgering voicemail.
Which I saved.
Good, because I hope to play that on our podcast. That would just be great. I'd like to hear it first, because I'm sure it wasn't good, but it was that mindset of that, just that very first full day in detox of me somehow thinking I was a hero because I had gone into detox, and that everyone out there was just praising me, going, wow, what a courageous man, he went into detox, and not realizing the bomb that I had just dropped on the people I loved and how devastated everybody was because of the fact I had hid this addiction. This was not something people were aware of. Some people thought maybe I had a drinking problem. Nobody realized that I was smoking meth and taking opiates.
One thing I wanted to add is that day that we dropped you off at detox, they had asked me to wait 24 hours while you adjust. And so, yes, I was purposefully ignoring your calls because I thought I was doing the right thing. We did talk, but, and it, you know, we didn't always have pleasant conversations.
Nope, we didn't. But that is something, and that's something that I just learned with you saying that. I didn't realize they had asked you not to.
Well, we had talked about this. So you were in the room when they talked about, you know, give them 24 hours. But you told me when you walked through the door of the detox facility, what did you have in your pocket?
Pills.
And you took?
Several.
And then you tossed the rest.
I threw the rest in the garbage.
Because your whole affect changed about a half an hour into the paperwork signing. And yeah. So I think you just forgot, to be honest.
You're probably right.
So talk about how you felt going to rehab from detox.
That was also a little frightening, but accepting in detox, I realized I had a drinking problem. I honestly thought I was going to detox, going to do my 6 days and get out, and at least I would still be able to drink. I honestly felt that alcohol was not a problem for me, and it wasn't until I woke up for the third morning in a row and all I wanted was a beer. The other drugs were not on my mind. It was the beer I wanted. So accepting the fact that I did need treatment, but even going in, it was like, I'm going to do my 30 days and then I'll be out and everything will be back to normal. So going into treatment, residential treatment is what I'll call it. You can call it rehab if you want, but we prefer recovery center. I was a little bit frightened of that transition just because I was gaining some clarity every day and starting to realize what I had done and how many people I had hurt in my addiction. Still had no clue the extent of it, but just enough that it was a heavy weight for somebody who'd been living so selfishly for so many years. And getting into residential treatment was much warmer environment. The people were very friendly, welcomed me in with open arms. I can't say enough good. I've fallen in love with a lot of people through my treatment process, and that's true love for life. Even though I've seen some fall away, I still care about them, and it hurts me. But back on track here, the recovery center was great. And I not only realized later into residential treatment, about 2 weeks in, when it dawned on me that I really love myself and I'm a good person, and I'd been locked in shame for a long time. And as I started to let that go, I started advocating for more time in residential, and didn't even look like I was going to get it. I mean, it was up to the day before I was supposed to discharge.
And you needed it.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been bad if you had left after the 30 days.
I agree. Probably could have used another couple of weeks, but I was denied an additional extension. But I did go into day treatment straight from residential, and I'm glad I did that. And even from day treatment into IOP, which is intensive outpatient. It's a great program I'm in, and I can get more into that a little bit later. I don't want to tie up this. I'm trying to stay on point, but as you can tell, I'm a bit of a rambler. So anyway, that's kind of how it went. The transition from residential to day treatment was pretty intense as well, because now I'm leaving the safety of pretty much 24/7 accountability, and now I'm on my own. So that was a little frightening, but this step from day treatment to IOP was not nearly as terrifying. So if I can ask you, what was the level of devastation that I spoke a little bit about just a bit ago to you personally?
Well, it was awful. I'm usually don't need a lot of people in my life. I mean, I'm very independent, but I needed, and to my family's credit, they were great. They helped come over and helped me. Your adult children and their spouses were amazing. And I needed all the help. I mean, at the time, our little baby was only 2 months old. She also had her hip health problems. She had to be in a harness most of the time. I remember after dropping you off at the detox center, my sister and her husband came with me. And we got home probably about 3 a.m. And the baby had been sick. I'd picked her up. I was holding her. She threw up in the bed. So I just cleaned her up. I put her in new jammies. I was so tired. I didn't even change the sheets. And I just slept under the other side of the bed. That's not normal, Amy. I wouldn't do that. But it was just that level of exhaustion. I was so sad. I'm not one to cry, but I did a lot. My sister would come over and she'd sleep over at night to help me because she knew I needed all the support, and it was so kind of her. I think the hard thing was also discovering how deep your addiction was. I started to research what was going on in your life. I looked through your cell phones. I looked through, you know, what I could to kind of piece everything together. I knew from looking at your personal account, you had gone through all of the money in it. It was actually in the negative.
And you want to give the dollar value here or not really?
Well, yeah. I mean, you had gone through at least $50,000 in savings.
In less than 12 months.
And this was from selling your house. And I remember going, crap, that was money that we were saving for retirement. You know, that was money that was there as a safety net. I remember moving money over from my account to your account just to make sure you weren't in the red. I found out that your personal credit card was almost maxed out and you had you'd been behind on paying it off on time and sending the monthly payment. And just, you know, I was able to look at what you were spending on. A lot of it was gas station runs to buy booze. Some, you know, a lot of them were the cash withdrawals and things like that. And I had to pick up the pieces and make sure that your financial situation was fixed. I was really mad at you, but I didn't want your situation to get worse. I remember, I think that week I sent over a payment to your credit card just to bridge the gap. And that was hard. I thought back to all your past behavior and your sleeping issues and everything and went, this all makes sense. And then realized, gosh, you had driven under the influence, whether it was alcohol and a combination of drugs. You had driven us on trips. You had driven yourself to work. You had driven the baby on errands. And safety is a really important thing to me. And that really, really hurt my heart. I found out that you had lied about your work situation. I knew you were struggling at work. I knew that you had been put on a leave of absence, which you were honest about to start with. And ended up finding out that your employers knew about your addiction about a week and a half prior. And really, I was the last to know. I was so mad. When I was going through your cell phone, I found some of these vague exchanges, and I could tell they were likely a drug exchange, and I confronted one of these dealers. I met them, and I was able to find out what they were giving you, and I gave them a piece of my mind.
Out for blood.
I was mad. I was setting fires everywhere. Honestly, if we didn't have a child together, I would have confronted each and every one of your dealers. But you told me some of them shouldn't be touched because they are dangerous people. Some of them aren't so much. One of your dealers had bragged about you taking the baby on a deal. We found out that was untrue, but that was really devastating to me because I'm thinking, out of all the people that you could hurt through this, don't hurt the baby. I'm tougher. I can deal with it, but she's just a little innocent girl. I was really glad that we were able to find out, though, that that was untrue.
Yeah, even though I didn't recall it, but considering that my reputation was shit at the time, and pardon my French there, considering my word at the time was worthless, I didn't even want to try to battle it, but I was also very happy to come to the realization that did not happen and state my case and have you be willing to listen to me and explore it to find that it wasn't true.
And I would like to beat up that specific dealer. I'm just saying. I'm not a violent person, but, you know, I'm still really mad about that. Your meth dealer knows where we live. That scared me a lot. I actually changed some of our home security to help deal with people visiting the house. So smile, everybody. If you come to visit us, you're on camera. I think the hardest thing was just finding out all the lies upon lies upon lies and the deception and questioning, who are you? You know, in the meanwhile, it was my birthday, then it was Thanksgiving, then it was your birthday and Christmas. And I mean, there's no good time for anybody to deal with addiction, but it made for a hard holiday season. Luckily, I had done all the Christmas shopping prior to going into detox because I'm prepared like that. So everybody had a good Christmas. At least I gave gifts to everyone. And but I still haven't put away the Christmas tree, and it's almost Valentine's Day. So there you go, everyone. Judge away. I am the lady with the Christmas tree still up in her living room. And guess what? I don't care.
Oh, my God. Did you hear? She hasn't put away her Christmas tree. Oh, my gosh. What am I going to do about
it? I actually kept it up because it made me happy through January, because I always find it to be a little bit of a dark and dreary time. And so I thought, you know what? It's been a crappy 2017 as far as the end of it goes. And so I'm going to leave the tree up and turn the lights on and enjoy it. In the end, I think the hardest thing was coming to terms with, you weren't the person I thought you were. You weren't the man I thought I married. And you weren't the man I thought I loved. And trying to reconcile those feelings.
Yeah, you had no idea. I mean, I'd been hiding the addiction since before we met from many other people. So just so that people are aware of that, that this addiction was completely... surprise to you. You were blindsided by it.
And not a fun birthday surprise. It's not like, yay, we got you a trip to Disneyland.
Well, it's just going to make future birthdays that much more fun. Hey, Chris didn't go to rehab again.
Yay. So I want to ask you, what did you lose from your addiction?
A lot. Oh, geez. Where do I start? My job, which came with a car, I had a company vehicle, full paid insurance covered, gas covered. All I had to do was pay taxes on my personal miles. I lost a cell phone through that job. I lost, you know, insurance benefits that go with that job. And most devastating of all is I lost my home with you, and I lost my marriage. Because I don't blame you for what you've done, but you had to protect yourself and our daughter, and you had no idea who I truly was. And so the marriage ended as well.
And to add to that, yes, we are getting a divorce. And yes, we are still together and love each other. And yes, that sounds very, very strange to people, but I don't care.
Yeah, it's not, it still hurts a little bit to say it out loud, but I also know where we're at personally, emotionally together. We are working as a solid team right now, but that trust is still being built, and I have a long way to go, and I'm aware of that. So losing my marriage, my family, my home were the three biggest by far. It's still a little bit painful to say that out loud, but I'm grateful to be here.
And I have hope for the future for us. Really, the only reason why we're getting divorced is for legal reasons, for protection of the child. Really, that's it. I love Chris. I didn't stop loving you. I continue to love you. So.
And I love you.
Thanks. I guess we're just one of those complex relationships that people would have a hard time understanding.
And if you want to understand more, keep listening to the podcasts here on DORK Radio.
Is that what we are now?
Dork Radio. So if I can ask you, kind of without trying to sound like I'm tying it in, but I just, one thing I wanted to get out was when you found out this, so I go into detox and this world starts to just unfold in front of you. Did you want to run? And why didn't you run?
I knew I wanted to see you through this. I wanted to see if you would take it seriously, and I wanted to see if you would embrace sobriety. That was really important to me. And I loved you. I was very, very angry. And I don't know if you remember what I said to you while we were driving to detox. That was probably the most serious threat I ever made to you.
Well, if I recall correctly, it was something to do with lying.
It was actually, you better fix this, or I will take every penny I have to make sure that you never see our daughter again so you can't hurt her.
I remember that.
And I meant it. I'm not one to threaten, but that was my threat.
Well, your actions since then have proven that you meant that. You've set boundaries, and you've stood by them firmly. And it's up to me to respect them and fix this.
And I think that you can, and you are. But let's talk about the positive things. I want to know, what have you gained from overcoming addiction?
Life. I have never known life sober as an adult, even though I didn't get locked into daily use of drugs and alcohol until I was in my mid-20s. I still was running from a lot. I had dropped a lot of bombs on a lot of people in a very short amount of time as a young adult, and just getting sober and feeling so good about it and learning a lot of things in treatment that, while I don't recommend people go get an addiction so they can go learn these things, this is a gift to me to be able to take these tools I've been given to apply to life, not just sobriety, but living, including meditation. I can't believe what a powerful tool meditation is for me. So if I can sum it up in one word, it would be life. But if you want me to sum it up in a bunch of words, it's meditation and mindfulness and being present and aware that I'm aware, so I'm awake. You know, Zen. So I think also I learned how much you loved me. That meant a lot to me too. You dove into this as a student, as well as a caring friend, if that's a word I could use here. You learned a lot too. I'd like to ask you, what have you learned about addiction since my treatment began?
I think the bigger aha moment for me was understanding that it's a disease of choice. And I always thought, okay, you chose to get into this condition, so choose to get out of it. And I think a lot of people have the same mindset.
Mm-hmm.
We'll stop doing drugs. If you're an addict to drugs, we'll stop doing them. If you're an alcoholic, we'll stop drinking. And it seems that simple, but it's not that simple, because you've made so many choices to get to that point that the mind gets very clouded. Willpower seems like it would be the logical way to get out there, but it's really intensive therapy and treatment and a change of mindset and choices and a lot of other things along the way that lead to recovery. And it's not just, okay, made all the changes, now I'm better. It's this ongoing process, an ongoing mindset of staying away from the addictive substances.
New neural pathways. There's five words you can live on. New neural pathways.
I can say math is not your strong suite, but hey.
And I think that is a good point. You know, I've been a little bit more empathetic toward people locked in addiction, but I think I've also been known to maybe point a finger to try to cover up my own addiction when I was hiding it. But I do understand the reality of wanting out of addiction, but not being able to think far enough ahead to even get it or have the courage to ask for help. It's hard to do. There are a lot of things that I learned that surprised me about addiction. I mean, what are some things that maybe surprised you about addiction?
I think the scariest thing that is on my mind is the stats are not in favor for people that go through treatment because relapse is high. You'll see about 85% of people that go through treatment.
15% make it.
Exactly, the positive side. But the negative side, 85% of people relapse after their first year of treatment. Now, to help combat that statistic, the longer you stay in treatment, regardless of what you're doing, if it's residential, IOP, things like that, the more committed you are in involving yourself in those sober communities and aftercare, the better the outcome is. And one thing I think I had to really learn, because I can't stop you from using drugs. I mm-hmm. wish I could. But if people are going to use, they are going to use. It doesn't matter how much they love somebody. It doesn't matter who's championing them. If you're going to use, you're just going to use. That's how it is.
That is true.
So what did you learn about yourself while you were in treatment?
I think I mentioned this earlier. I learned that I was a good person, but I just made really bad choices. And those bad choices led me down a path to addiction, and shame was a big contributor to me staying locked in addiction. I didn't realize how much shame ruled my life. Shame actually ruled the addiction that ruled me. So shame was the big boss in there, and I was riddled with shame. I didn't even realize that I was. I knew I was ashamed of myself for being locked in addiction, but had no idea the extent of how much it was keeping me locked in addiction. So what did you learn about me, honey?
I learned what a good manipulator
that you are. We already covered that.
But you are a master manipulator. You're not alone. A lot of addicts are. I would say
all of us.
Yeah, they are so good at manipulation. And I've really learned to kind of be clueful. One thing, and we talked about it even today in a therapy session, I've asked you to use your powers for good. So rather than being somebody who manipulates, be somebody who helps persuade for good things for other people, through service, through people who can't advocate for their own needs. And that's something that's really important to me. And I think service is a huge part of recovery. I've also found that when you put your mind to something, good or bad, you succeed.
Thank you. I can get things done when I try.
So what are your hopes for the future?
Well, the immediate future, I want to complete the treatment program that I'm in. By the time all is completed, I will have almost 150 days of treatment. Both that includes detox, residential, day treatment, intensive outpatient treatment. And then have a good aftercare program in place, which I'm working on now. I think I have a pretty good aftercare program already set up, ready to roll, but I'm still exploring other opportunities because, you know, 3 nights a week is what I need to be focused on for aftercare. When treatment's done, I need 3 nights a week where I'm involved with sober communities doing things. And I have 3 things that I enjoy doing. Meditating. Those are my 3 aftercare programs. But I need other things as well. So I do want to gain full-time employment. I am being very careful with that right now just because the brain healing from addiction after decades is certainly, and this is something you and I have talked about, this is not an excuse to not have to work full-time, but I do need to be careful about overloading my head. I get fatigued very easily. And I want to continue to play music. Music is a huge part of us, you and I. We met through music, and we play music together a lot, and it's something that bonds us. We love concerts. We love watching music on TV, just listening to the radio, singing to the baby, getting her boogie on, boots with the fur.
She loves that too.
And so I think those are key, but most of all, I look forward to earning trust all the way back from you and your family, my family. I know that that's a long road, but once I was able to just accept the fact that I don't get to decide when other people trust me again, things really seem to start to fall in place for me. And so I've got a ways to go, but those are my key things looking forward.
And I think those are great, and I think they're definitely achievable, and I can't wait to see them happen.
Thanks.
Well, we hope you enjoyed listening to our story about recovery.
Holla.
If you have any comments or questions, please let us know by going to our contact page on our website. Yes, we have a website. It is www.loverecoveryrr.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Now on to our favorite part, rock and roll.
Rock and roll, that website again is www.loverecoveryrr.com. So tell your mom, tell your sister, tell your boyfriend. So the rock and roll part here, we are going to pick a song each week. We're not sure what we can get away with playing, so we're just going to put a link to it on the podcast site. This week, I have chosen the song Wake Up Time by one of my all-time favorites, Tom Petty, who we lost to a drug overdose just recently here. But Wake Up Time is on the Wildflowers album, and it's pretty self-explanatory. Go listen to this song. It's beautiful. It's a good tune. It's kind of an in-your-face wake up, but the chorus just simply says, it's wake up time, time to open up your eyes and rise and shine. Good day.